Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real-world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm joined by a good old friend of mine, Lewis McCormack. Hey, man.
Yeah. Hi, Ian. How you doing?
So, Lewis, we've known each other for a little while, and I've really enjoyed our time working together at the Space Ape. And for the audience who haven't heard about Space Ape, can you tell us a bit about the company and what you do there?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Lewis McCormack, and I am a DevOps engineer at a company called Space Ape Games. We are a mid-sized mobile games company based in central London. We're a little over 8 years old, and I've been there for coming up to 7 of those 8 years. And in that time, we've put 4 titles live, and we've got another handful of games that we're very excited about that are getting increasingly close to being put live. Our tech stack, we're a games company, a mobile games company. So we have game clients that run on mobile devices, typically people's mobile phones. And they're written in Unity. And they talk to some back-end infrastructure, which takes the form of game servers, written almost exclusively in Scala. And they run on Fargate, on AWS. So notably for this podcast, we don't use Lambdas to serve game traffic. And that is mainly because, as mentioned, our backend services are written in Scala. Scala, for those that don't know, is like a functional skin on top of Java. And there are sort of some well-known issues with running JVM-based applications in Lambdas. It's difficult to get away from that cold start time when a process has to build a JVM and load lots of stuff into memory. But that's not to say we don't run any Scala Lambdas. We absolutely do. They just tend not to be user-facing, so it's sort of back-end management type stuff and data processing jobs. But despite us not running our game services on Lambda, we are still big fans of serverless, and particularly from a DevOps standpoint. And that's, I suppose, in large part what I'm here to talk about today.
Yeah, I think the whole serverless adoption at the Space Ape is quite interesting and quite different from a lot of other companies, where a lot of the other companies I've spoken to on this podcast, the drive to push for serverless is coming from the development team, where they want to, get away from having to manage servers, from having to patch in the OS and all of that, and just write business logic. But like you said, Space Ape, because everything's written in Scala, there's a very rich tool set of things the guys have done, some really clever things, which hopefully maybe at some point we can talk about that. And but it also means that we can't really feasibly run Scala for the user facing stuff in Lambda because of the cold start, but also because of the traffic. There's fairly high usage on those APIs, and some of them are even serving. The game that me and Lewis worked on has been cancelled. So we don't do this the socket based real time multiplayer anymore. But still, there's a lot of work that Lewis and his team in SpaceX was doing using Lambda, and there are also some use cases around machine learning, if I remember correctly. From that perspective, Lewis, maybe can you talk about some of the things you guys are doing from the DevOps angle and how serverless and Lambda has really helped you guys there?
Yeah, sure. So we use serverless for many, many use cases. And I think for me, the real enabler in AWS, the real sort of clincher, is actually something that doesn't get much praise, I don't think, and that is CloudWatch events. You can configure a CloudWatch event to be triggered by any single action that occurs throughout your entire AWS estate, which means you can respond to anything that happens in any of your AWS accounts. And the response might take different forms. If the thing that triggered the event was a security concern, then it might send an alert. It might take some remedial action to prevent an engineer having to get out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, for instance. Or it might be sort of a functional response. For instance, we have a Lambda that gets triggered whenever a CloudWatch logs group is created, and it comes into life and it subscribes that CloudWatch log groups to a set of predefined subscriptions. And so this being able to respond to events is a very powerful thing. However, I think there's certainly for us at Space Ape, and certainly for some other operations teams that I've spoke to in the past, there's there's one particular use case that kind of acts as a springboard or a gateway drug into the world of serverless. And that for us at least was to use it as a sort of a cron replacement. A bit of context about that. Back in the pre-cloud days, it was quite common for ops teams for there to be this kind of mysterious opaque server in if you're lucky in the corner of the server room, or if you're unlucky, it's underneath somebody's desk. And legend has it that the cleaner came along and accidentally turned it off one day, and all hell broke loose. And over time, it became a dumping ground for sort of random background tasks and cron jobs and mysterious demons. And you know, the people who knew what those things are have left the company, and it's at a point where, you know, this, no one really knows what this box does, only that you can never turn it off or your whole business will come crumbling down around you. And then cloud came along, and we moved this box from underneath somebody's desk to an EC2 instance, and probably the same sort of pattern emerged. And now I guess you're probably no danger of the cleaner accidentally turning it off, but you do know the thing about EC2 instances like death and taxes is that at some point they will get terminated. So arguably you're in a worse position. And of course, good ops teams probably didn't do this, and they found ways to manage this. I'm not pretending this is a pathology of ops engineers or anything, but I do reckon if you talk to any ops engineer with a long enough career, they'll sort of smile fondly and they'll know what I'm talking about. But yeah, you might wonder where I'm going with all this, but serverless does help us out with this, because it came along and it dawned on us that, hang on a minute, you don't need a mysterious box running cron jobs like a glorified scheduler. You can use Lambdas as a glorified scheduler, you know, with scheduled events to do the same thing. And obviously you're no longer running underneath somebody's desk or an EC2 instance that will go away. You're running on some infrastructure that will just continue to work day after day after day. And of course, you could just do the same thing. Instead of creating a cobbling together a random cron job at 3 o'clock in the morning, you could cobble together a random Lambda and never tell anyone about it. And then you're probably in a worse position. But I think the thing with Lambdas is they force you to have a bit more process around things, because they kind of force you. The old cron job 3 a.m. scripts would generally be bash scripts, and Lambdas sort of force you to use a proper programming language. Sorry to any bash fans out there, and I'm sure you can run bash on Lambda. I've never tried that, but generally you're forced to use a proper programming language, and this means you'll probably use proper development constructs like a separate code repo, tests and documentation, and the whole thing became a little bit more visible and known. And the point I'm trying to make is I think this kind of glorified scheduler use case was a stepping stone and kind of opened our eyes to the other possibilities that serverless brings.
Yeah, I remember you guys went from using batch for a lot of things to writing a lot of stuff in Go around that time when you were moving a lot of the, so I guess, old cron jobs from EC2 instances to Lambda. And I guess you guys are also doing some really interesting stuff around security and stuff as well, because, you know, as anyone who's made a popular mobile game or any kind of game would probably tell you that someone's going to try to hack it. Someone's going to try to do something. Having been able to react to various events happening in your AWS ecosystem using CloudWatch Events, or I guess nowadays you can probably call it Event Bridge, is also quite a powerful thing as well. I think you touched on that earlier as well, didn't you? You mentioned some of the event-driven stuff you're doing whenever something happens in your AWS account and you run some Lambda to do automated remediation.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. For some reason, hackers feel that they've got an open season on games. They sort of try and hack it for fun. So yeah, we have to be very secure. And yeah, we use CloudWatch Events and serverless more generally to help us manage security. I mentioned earlier, yeah, you can have a Lambda which triggers. For instance, we have an alert which is triggered whenever anyone logs in as root to any of to the AWS console of any of our accounts. We have an alert which is triggered, and it sends an alert to a Slack channel, and we are asked to find the person who's logging in as root and ask them why they're doing that. Occasionally there's good reason for it, of course, but you know, if we don't find the person who's logged in as root, which has never happened, by the way, we could have a problem. But that's a kind of almost a trivial example of how we use CloudWatch events for security monitoring. More generally, we use AWS config rules. And these are a way to represent policy as code, which is a sort of a movement that's gaining traction. And policy isn't just security policy. It could be things like naming standards or a tagging policy. But we use it generally to enforce security policy. And the way that config rules work are that they can be configured to trigger a Lambda to run whenever certain objects in your estate are changed. For instance, we have a config rule that is triggered whenever any changes made to any EC2 security group throughout our estate. And what happens is this Lambda is triggered and it just sort of parses the change that has just been made. And it just sort of identifies if the change that has been made could lead to a security issue. For instance, if someone had just opened up a port to the internet, then config rules would pick that up. The Lambda would decide that that's something that probably shouldn't be done. And it would, again, notify us, the DevOps team. And we then, it's our job to go and find out who made this change and why they made this change. 99% of the time, it's somebody just spinning up a proof of concept of some new technology. Perhaps they're working at home and they just wanted to open up the admin console of this proof of concept, which is okay as long as it's only a short-term thing and we just make sure that it is a short-term thing. But without config rules to help us there, we would be utterly none the wiser that this thing had happened. That's just a single example. We have many more config rules. And it's just we found it's an incredibly powerful thing to be able to respond to events in this way.
Yeah, that kind of underpins the whole DevSecOps movement that's been, I guess, getting a lot of momentum the last 12 months or so. And I think that's definitely something that I'm seeing more and more now, especially in the enterprise space where people are using Lambda with AWS Config to, like you said, provide the governance and to enforce consistent naming conventions and the security practices to everyone who's deploying stuff into their AWS environment. And I think that's a really good direction for the industry to be going, rather than having gatekeeping where you've got one team that have to basically double check everything that everyone is trying to deploy, to having that team be able to just say, you know what, we're going to define a bunch of guardrails and then rules and let you do whatever, so long that whatever you're doing falls within the boundary of what we define in terms of the best practices, in terms of the rules that we configure. And I think this definitely is a nice welcome change of pace, certainly in that particular space. There was also one other use case that we worked on together when we were at the Space Ape, but was we were using Lambda to do some load testing against this multiplayer online, a MOBA that we were building, right? Is that a thing you guys are still doing, using Lambda to do essentially load testing?
It absolutely is, yeah. This is probably my favorite thing that we use Lambdas for. And it's still, Jan, you'll be pleased to know, we're still using the same system we developed when you were with us as well.
Nice.
So yeah, load testing is it's extremely important to us. As we ramp up to a global launch, we need to be sure that our systems can handle the load which we expect them to receive. We may be going from zero or very few players to like hundreds of thousands or even millions of currently connected players. And we need to have as much confidence as we can that our systems are not going to just fall over. There's some well publicized examples of games suddenly receiving a lot of load and their servers not being able to cope. And we don't want to be another example. So the way that we do that is we generate artificial load through load testing. And we have a fairly elaborate sort of load testing infrastructure that Jan helped us build. And it's built using serverless constructs. And the basic premise is that with a single request against an API gateway endpoint, we are able to spin up an army of Lambdas, each running a load test client, and they'll sort of focus like a tractor beam on a given endpoint and run a load test through. And once it's complete, they report metrics back through SQS queues, and they eventually percolate through to Dynamo, and the results are collated, and we can look at them in a like a nice web UI. Our load testing really has two phases. The first is driven by Jenkins. And when a game server is built, a load test client is built alongside it on every single build. That's how important it is to us. And then Jenkins will actually spin up a version of that game server and expose an endpoint. It will then call into our load test infrastructure, ask for 100 or 200 Lambdas to generate some load. They'll point the load at that game service. Jenkins itself collates the results, and it uses them just to confirm that performance hasn't regressed. We haven't made anything worse in that code change. So we can sort of be guaranteed that our services are as performant as they ever were, at least. But the second phase is the more exciting phase, especially for me. That's as we ramp up to big launches. We run what's called a large-scale load test, and for this, we build an entire production-like environment. And be honest, 9 times out of 10, we just use production if it's before the game has launched, and then we just wipe the tables afterwards. But we then use the same process. We call into our load testing infrastructure, ask for hundreds, perhaps even thousands of Lambdas. They generate some load. The problem that we ran into here is we sort of ran into some of the limitations of Lambdas at this point. The first one is the obvious one. They're limited to 15 minutes. We have load tests which run for, well, most of them run for at least an hour. Some even run for days. We run a thing called a soak test to kind of weedle out any problems that might arise from running a system over time. So the 15 minutes is a problem. And also, Lambdas are limited in processing power. This was true right up until yesterday when they announced at re:Invent that I think is it 10 gig and 6 core Lambdas are a thing now.
Yep, that's right, a 10 gig.
Yeah, so that's they're not so limited in processing power anymore, but they were when we designed this system. To generate the equivalent load of, say, a million currently connected players, we needed something a bit beefier, and so we turned to Fargate, actually. We're already using Fargate to run our services, so it seemed a natural fit. And it's the same process, exactly the same Lambdas are launched, but instead of running the load test client through to completion, there's a flag that they see has been set, and they morph into Fargate tasks. They don't really morph. They just launch a Fargate task and then terminate themselves. But the net result is the same. We end up with hundreds or thousands of very large Fargate tasks generating an incredible amount of load. And it's phenomenal, actually. We've never run a round of these large-scale load tests and not found a problem, like a problem that would have caused us considerable pain when we launch. It's a very, very, very useful thing for us.
Sounds like the system has progressed quite a bit since I was there, and also gotten a lot more sophisticated, which is, I guess, kudos to you guys. I guess maybe for people that are listening and who are maybe not familiar with the specific context, one thing they're going to be thinking about right now is why do you build your own, load test client? Why not just use something like JMeter or the whole bunch of different, I guess, the off-the-shelf solutions? Why do you guys have to do all of this work yourself?
Yeah, that's a good question. If we were running a website, something like that, then yes, we could use JMeter or any of the other load testing tools that are out there. But our game code is very, very complicated. It has to be. There's a lot that goes into making these games, and a single HTTP request response is just not going to be able to trouble or to test all of the different code paths. So we need these load test clients to be sort of consciously developed with some a lot of thought goes into them as well to make sure that we do cover all the different eventualities. I think, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess. And also, I guess that they don't really speak a lot of the sort of more standard application protocols. I remember there was a lot of proprietary application level protocols that was being used because to get the most efficient bandwidth use or the most efficient, I guess, to get the most performance. There was a lot of custom stuff being done in there, at least certainly on the mobile that we worked on. There was a whole custom reliable UDP protocol. On top of that, a custom application level protocol just so that we can as tightly squeeze the bytes into a packet as we can. So, you know, we couldn't quite replicate those the same, you know, even just network layer, transport layer implementations into one of the standard load test clients you can find out there. I guess that is still kind of true in the other games that you guys have developed, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a lot of proprietary protocols. Multiplayer aside, which is the thing that you were talking about, we use Protobuf as a sort of a protocol delivery mechanism, and within that we have a lot. You know, we've been around for 8 years. We've built up a lot of tech that makes these games possible, and there's a lot of kind of cross compilation between languages and a lot of shared model type stuff. So, yeah. Going back to the original thing, a simpler tool like JMeter is just not going to cut it.
Yeah, I remember some of the more crazier things that there was done there. Things like not just using protocol buff, but also having a tier on top of protocol buff that gives you generics and things like that, which you don't have in the raw, you know, protocol buff protocol. So, you know, there was some stuff that Andy did. I remember that was some, you know, pretty next level stuff that he was doing. So again, those kind of things that makes it difficult or maybe impossible to use a more off the shelf solution for when it comes to load testing. But really interesting to see how you guys are now missing Fargate with Lambda in this case. And I guess it's just basically a toggle so that you decide when to run the load test in Lambda versus when to run them in Fargate.
It is, yes. And I guess that's another thing that probably wasn't around when you worked at Space8 was Fargate. If it was, it was probably prohibitively expensive or not quite usable. But we're big fans of Fargate now, not just in load testing, but as I mentioned, we run all of our services on it for us. And the real benefit as we see it is, it's obvious, but you don't have to manage the cluster that your containers are running on. And I know that Amazon are billing it, AWS bill it as serverless, but I wondered what your thoughts on that were.
I don't really care too much about whether or not something is labeled as a serverless. I really just care about not having to do stuff. So if I don't have to, and Fargate is lets me run containers without having to worry about provisioning the underlying cluster and do a lot of the management stuff. So for me, I mean, it gets a lot of the benefits you get with serverless. But one thing is probably missing is something similar to what Google has with Cloud Run, where you've got that event trigger, which is something that the Fargate doesn't have right now. And hopefully, you know, maybe there's still time in the reInvent this year. So maybe they will find time to actually squeeze in. And that would be a big plus for people that are using Fargate. Actually, another one that's seeing more and more people use as a serverless container instead of Fargate is CodeBuild, which also lets you trigger and run some task on a container without having to provision underlying cluster. And that's a... And the difference is that it's triggered by some kind of event. And also, it lets you use a bigger instance than Fargate. So Fargate has, I think the maximum instance that you can have on Fargate is quite a bit smaller compared to what you can have on the code build. So we also see now people using code build, which is, if you're new to it, it's basically something that lets you, well, it's like a CI tool that lets you build your code and deploy them on a container. Using a container image, but then you can also just use that to run any container image on some trigger that you can use to trigger a code build task. So yeah, that's also kind of interesting.
That is interesting. Yeah, I didn't know that. I didn't know that people were using code build for things outside of build pipelines. We do use code build ourselves in the build pipeline, but we hadn't quite realize that you could use it elsewhere as well. I think the maximum size of a Fargate task is is 8 cores and 32 gig, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what CodeBuild can do.
Yeah, have a look. I think CodeBuild can probably have maybe 16 or 12 core, or maybe even bigger than that. I can't remember. But it was definitely, when I looked at it last time, it has a much bigger maximum instance you can get compared to Fargate. And also with Fargate, I guess you still have the default limit of quite a small number of tasks you can run in per region. So I guess you guys had to raise that to a much higher maximum so that you can run all of your game servers and as well as your load testing clients.
Yes, we do. Yeah, that's one of the first things we do. I think the limit's 500 per region, but yeah, we make sure that gets raised.
Okay. Yeah, 500 is actually much higher than the, what was it, when you launched it, or maybe even like a year and a half ago, it was much lower. Remember at the, when I was at the zone, we tried to use Fargate, and the first limit we ran into was like 20 Fargate tasks or something like that per region. It was really low, and I guess they must have raised that recently.
Yeah, I may be wrong. It may be 100, but I'm pretty sure it's higher than 20 now.
Yeah, okay, all right, that's good. I guess another thing that we can probably talk about is you've got this idea that looking at the serverless landscape, and you said it's looking more and more like a Linux system. So can you maybe talk to us about that and explain your thinking?
I have, yes. And disclaimer, this might be complete nonsense, but it's just something that I've began to notice over time. So I really believe that serverless is the next iteration of cloud. Like if you think serverless is cloud V2, then V1 is VMs and containers. And the thing with VMs is that they're kind of a lift and shift of a virtual machine. That's exactly what they are, a virtual machine that would have previously run in the data center. We've just taken those VMs and put them into the cloud, and containers portion up the VM a little bit more, and ECS and Kubernetes, and I'm a big fan of containers. They all push the boundaries a little, but they're still using that same concept. They're taking an operating system, generally a Linux OS, and running it in the cloud. And what strikes me about serverless is that instead of running a whole operating system in the cloud, I sort of see it as perhaps a DevOps engineer with a systems lens on it, as a Linux system exploded into the cloud. And I don't mean an explosion like the Big Bang. I mean exploded as in split out into the cloud. So I've got this theory, and bear with me, but you can draw some analogies from Linux operating system fundamentals to serverless constructs. So if you could think of the cloud as the CPU, like a constantly available source of compute, then lambdas, it's easy to imagine them as processes or tasks that are scheduled onto a CPU. System calls, this one is a bit of a stretch, I must admit. System calls are in Linux or Unix terms are when a process asks to be switched context into the kernel from user space to kernel space, generally because they're asking the kernel to do something like enact some disk IO or something like that. And system calls could be likened to calls into AWS, into the AWS API. So that would make AWS kind of the kernel. Interrupts are another thing in Unix systems. They trigger something based on an external event, like someone hitting a key on the keyboard or some sort of IO being ready. And doesn't take too much imagination to liken those to CloudWatch events. Then we've got daemons. I think most people know what daemons are, but they're long-running processes. Step functions kind of replicate that. And then if you think back to kind of basic Linux systems programming, there's a thing called IPC, which is inter-process communication. And it's a number of sort of well-defined ways that processes can communicate with each other. Things like semaphores, message queues, shared memory, shared files, and the system bus, the dbus. And over time, if you look at the features that AWS have bolted on to their serverless offering, it comes more and more to resemble this model. Again, if you keep in mind that I'm sort of imagining that lambdas are processes, then message queues, you know, a way for one process to put work onto a queue for another to pick up and process that work. They've got an obvious analogy. We've had message queues in the serverless world for a while. SQS, SNS, Kinesis, arguably. And then the system bus is another one, the system dbus, which is a way for processes to broadcast messages to others that happen to be listening on the bus. We've got the CloudWatch events bus. It's even called a bus, so it must be similar. Shared files as well. We've got, I think relatively recently, you can use EFS with Lambdas. Now, I'm really not sure of the wisdom of doing that, but you can do it. You can share files between sort of unrelated processes. And if you're using this model, it may be interesting to look at the things that are missing from the IPC module to try and guess what might come next. Just a fun exercise, really. I'm not really saying this is what Amazon are going to invent, but some of the things that are missing is semaphores. In cloud terms, that might be a global locking mechanism, or I don't know, leader election, something like that. I think that you don't actually need this in a serverless world. I think if you're using message queues properly, you can achieve the same thing by just having something consumed from a queue at a rate of one. But another thing that's missing is shared memory. And this kind of gets me thinking, maybe this wouldn't be such a bad thing. So what I'm talking about shared memory in the Linux world is the same piece of virtual memory mapped into two or more processes' address space. And the closest analogy I can draw in serverless is kind of global variables. When when a container starts, we are allowed to initialize some global variables. Maybe we're calling into SSM or Secrets Manager. Maybe it slows down the or increases the cold start somewhat. And then other functions which run in that same container are able to access that shared memory. They're able to access those global variables. Now, I'm not sure of the received wisdom these days in doing that. It's always worked fine for me. But I do wonder if there's something there, like maybe some way to share that. When I'm talking about memory, I'm talking about fast access to storage that might not necessarily be durable. So maybe there could be a way that Lambda functions could access data from some very fast storage that would result in us not having to sort of preload during the init phase of a container. I know we could use Elasticache Redis, which is probably the closest thing that we have at the moment. But there's the problem there with the Redis has a very hard limit on the number of connections. And if I think you would hit that limit pretty fast if you were scaling up thousands of lambdas. Anyway, yeah, that's my theory. Maybe it's the ramblings of a madman. I'm not sure.
No, I think there's definitely some truth to it. And in terms of the shared memory, Tim Wagner actually wrote something. God, when was that? I think definitely more than a year ago, when he was still at the AWS, where he found a way to basically allow the worker instances for Lambda function to intercommunicate with each other, almost like inter-process communication. So then you have a way, no, so with that, you kind of have a way to do that shared data, like point to point, at least rather than the mapping to a shared memory space. But that will definitely have some interesting use cases, even though I really like the shared nothing philosophy from Erlang. That shared nothing philosophy, I think, is a really powerful thing and allows you to scale and have independent failures that doesn't, you know, one process writes bad data and corrupts the memory and everyone else is have problems. So you don't have that kind of failure mode. But certainly, I think that's a really interesting line of thinking to explore maybe even further. And who knows, maybe like you said, AWS is going to come up with something that give you that sort of shared memory model for Lambda in the future. When they do, I'll definitely let you know.
Yes, please. One thing I guarantee with the things they announce is that they always surprise me. Even Lambda itself was a was a surprise when it first came out. I couldn't quite get my head around it, but they're obviously cleverer than me.
Well, they have a lot more data than we do in terms of what people are doing and what sort of problems that people have. And that's one of the great things about AWS, just in terms of that feedback into, you know, from customers straight into teams. Speaking about, company culture, Space Ape is by far the best company I've worked for in terms of company culture. From the sort of sales structure to some of the bottom up philosophy. I don't want to sort of spoil it for the listeners, but can you maybe tell us about, you know, how the sort of sales structure and the bottom up culture works at the Space Ape?
Yeah, I can. And thank you for saying that as well. We think we have a good culture as well. It's nice to hear it validated. But yeah, we do. We have a wonderful culture at Space Ape, really. I mean, we make games, which lends itself really to quite a playful environment. And it's a very democratic culture, actually. There's a very flat management hierarchy, which I think helps everyone to feel empowered, and movement between disciplines and sort of gaining skills in multiple disciplines is encouraged, which leads to less siloization and barriers. And notably, anyone in the company can come up with a game idea. Even a DevOps engineer like me could come up with a game idea. I mean, I haven't got a game idea, but I could come up with one. And then that idea can is sort of allowed to germinate, and it must pass a set of requirements and milestones and get buy-in from the rest of the company. And once it if it passes those sort of milestones, then a small game team is built around it, and it does start off small. And from that point on, all decision making around that particular game is left entirely to that team, even down to whether they should continue developing the game or not. And they'll be a game lead, and the game lead almost acts as like a mini CEO within that team. Obviously, they can seek advice and guidance from anyone else in the company, and are encouraged to do so. But we end up with a sort of a cell-like structure with several small teams developing games almost in isolation, but not really in isolation, because striating these game teams are a number of shared disciplines. We sort of call them guilds, shared guilds. We have a server guild, client guild, and a DevOps guild. And the idea is that ideas and progress and technologies that are used in each of the games are shared through these guilds. And so that way, the games aren't developed in isolation. They're just sort of developed on their own. And that's not the only way we share these ideas. They're also shared with the wider company at weekly show and tells and other ceremonies. So although we have very, you know, several small teams developing very distinct products, and they are very, very different games, there's never any mystery. Everything is shared, all the successes and failures. And I mean, there are a lot of failures. Failure is part of it. It's part of the process. And even decisions that are made at a higher level by our CEO and people like that, all of those decisions and successes and failures are shared too. And it just leads to a very healthy atmosphere, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I think the transparency from the top down has was probably one of the most important thing for my time there. Just understanding not exactly what to do, but what the company is looking for from you, and who we are as a company, as a culture. And I think the role that John and the Simon plays in terms of reiterating that every single quarter, in every single the quarterly company meeting, reiterating those culture, those sort of key points. I think that really helps, especially when you got new people joining, or just to remind, you know, people who's been there for 7 years, like yourself, you know, this is who we are, and we're not going to deviate from that. And I think there was a couple instances I remember clearly as well, when the was it like a birthday thing or something? There was some the company culture to, you know, do cake or something, and I think one person didn't want to do it, and then someone else was complaining about, oh yeah, you know, what happened to the cakes? And that's when sort of John kind of stepped in and just said, well, you know, we do need to celebrate, you know, the person whose birthday it is, you know. And trying to stop the sort of feeling of entitlement from creeping into the culture. And I think John really understands that once those those entitlements and bad things are creeping into your culture, it's really hard to stop. So he kind of just nipped in the bud.
Yeah, and absolutely. And you've kind of hit on something else there that we are very willing to adapt. And John, the CEO, is very honest that it's a learning process for all of us, including him. And we have adapted several times, course correction, whatever you want to call it. And I guess we will continue to do so. But that's, again, I think it's a healthy place to be.
Yes, definitely. And the fact that I think one thing we probably should also talk about on this whole culture topic is that how do we deal with failures? The fact that you let people decide when to kill their game is great. The fact that people can and are willing to do that means that there is a safety net in place. Because you see a lot of companies, especially large ones, whereby people drag on their project, they just hold, they hold their this the bit of the project or the space so that they have job safety, they have the security, knowing that you can't fire me because I'm the only one who knows this part of the process. And in fact, you see a lot of deliberate over-engineering just so that you create something so complex that no one else can touch it without you. Whereas in that space save is quite the opposite. So maybe talk about maybe can you sort of elaborate on some of the sort of safety net and how does it what happens when say as the game team we decided that this game is not gonna be top 10 grossing, so we don't want to build it and want to pursue other ideas. What happened to that team and what happened to you as an individual?
Yes, that's a good question. So just you mentioning that, it sort of reminds me of other places that I've worked where you see those sort of patterns, and it also reminds me how lucky I am to work at Space8, where that type of behavior just doesn't really exist. I think the first point you made, that it is down to the game teams as to whether they terminate their own games or not, and putting that power in the hands, the power of that decision in the hands of the team, leads to less ill feeling, as you can imagine. And it is the whole team as well. It's not just the game lead that suddenly decides it. The whole team are factored into these decisions. But I think another point is that what I mentioned before, because although the game teams are developing their own games, and they're not going to say there's no competition between them, they all want to develop the best games. It's a healthy competition, and everyone's aware of the other cool games that are being developed at the company. So they do know that if a game team gets disbanded, they can either they'll keep that same game team and come up with a completely, sometimes a completely new idea, sometimes a variation on the same idea. Or the game team will get completely disbanded and they'll go and join one of the other very cool projects that we've got going on. So there's not really a problem there.
I know, I remember John mentioning that this whole culture, this whole identity, was in part inspired by Supercell, who incidentally also ended up acquiring a part of SpaceApe. And I remember re watching a documentary or interview with the CEO of Supercell, and he just laughed and said, "I'm probably the least powerful CEO in the world." In fact, one of the teams that killed his favorite game idea ever, they killed it. But guess what? They ended up making a Clash Royale. So I think probably worked out pretty well for them.
Yes, I think no one would argue that. I think we learn a lot from Supercell. Of course we do. Even before they acquired us, I think we can part acquired us, I should say. We learn a lot from their practices.
So yeah, thank you for that, Lewis. And it's I guess for listeners who haven't experienced this kind of culture, is very refreshing. And like I said, it's by far the best company culture I've personally experienced in the workplace. And I do hope some of these ideas will be I guess more broadly accepted into other companies. And but yeah, it's been a great talking to you again and catching up on good old times.
Yes, yeah, it has been, Jan. Yeah, hopefully we can meet up in person before long.
And before we go, how can people reach out to you and find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter at LewisM517. That's about all I'm on, actually. I'm not much of a social tech guy.
Yeah, I remember all the guys at the SpaceApe were all very much get a head down, build games, I was probably the only man who was constantly spending time on Twitter and on blogs and
I should say as well, we are always hiring, and so if you like what you've heard at all, we're spaceapegames.com/careers is the place to look.
Yep, and it's one of the best places to work, like I said. So yeah, go check it out. And with that, I guess thank you so much, Lewis, and hope to catch up in person soon.
Yes, thanks, Jan. Yeah, thanks for having me again.
Take it easy, man. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.